Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast that shares open conversations with great guests about their lives and influences in a very human way. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Deborah Mogark. Welcome, Deborah. Great to meet you. We're here at the very first Stoke by Nayland Live Literature Festival in Suffolk. Deborah Mogark is an accomplished women's writer of 19 novels, a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, a prolific scriptwriter for TV and stage plays, a journalist, and even a BAFTA-nominated screenwriter. Deborah, that is amazing.
It does sound rather impressive now you put it like that.
And it certainly is impressive. But you're from a family of incredible writers, Deborah, aren't you? So is it an inherited gene?
Well, I rather rebelled against it when I was little because I didn't want to do what my parents did. I mean, my father wrote 120 books, he once added them up. And my mother wrote about 40 and illustrated them. They were children's books. But my father put his hand to anything. He was a historian. He wrote children's books. He wrote biographies. He wrote a book that was made into that Mutiny on the Bounty film with Anthony Hopkins. He just put his hand to anything, really. So they taught me, after I'd stopped rebelling and thinking that I didn't want to be a writer and I wanted to be other things, they taught me by example, discipline in a way, because every morning they worked. They never said, I don't feel like it today. So they had a very good work ethic. Well, they had to, because they were bringing up, in our case, four girls, and they had to make a living doing it.
Wow, so it's really a discipline. You write every day yourself, do you?
I write every morning, and I feel quite weird and sort of nauseous if I don't. I really do have to. But in the afternoon, I'm hopeless. I just can't write. And I do know quite a lot of writers who don't work in the afternoon. Early evening, I have a nice big glass of white wine and sit down at 6:30, and I can work for a couple of hours then. But otherwise, the afternoon's a sort of dead time. Not dead, I become a normal person and, you know, go for a walk and do the shopping and load the dishwasher.
What an idyllic life. And you've got a daughter whose first novel is now being adapted for television too, so you must have some great family get-togethers.
Well, it certainly seems to have gone through the generations, yes, because my son also does journalism. He's a primary school teacher, and he does journalism as well. And my daughter's writing her third novel. She's had one published, and as you're saying, yes, Netflix is doing it as a big drama, which is great. She's got another one coming out in July this year, 2017. So we're all at it. It's difficult to know how much it's example, how much it's nature, how much nurture, all that. But it is an extraordinarily wonderful and privileged way of earning a living if one can do it. Although when you are sitting there stuck and you're gnawing the end of your pencil or gazing at this laptop, it's difficult when you're stuck, which can happen. And because then you feel completely useless because you've not done anything else. You haven't phoned your friends, you haven't cleaned the house, you haven't done anything. But when it's going well and you're humming away and the novel, in my case, you know, novel fiction, is in your head all the time and those characters have assumed a life, more of a substance in your life than your, you know, friends and family, that's when you're really cooking and when a novel's going well. And it's very delicious because you can't wait to get back to it. And the characters can then take on a momentum of their own. And I mean, I think all novelists will describe that. And it's a lovely feeling because they start to tell you their story. And V.S. Pritchett said, there's no such thing as plot. There is just character. And those characters will tell you, if they're living enough and breathing enough and alive, they will tell you their story. And you just follow them. And it's a very wonderful experience when it goes well.
That is amazing to be in such an incredible family. My goodness. Would you say your writing style is mainly about relationships, friendships and matters of the heart, that, you know, the foibles of being human?
I would say that all novelists are. That's their subject. I mean, I do disagree with dividing, you know, supposed women's novels off from the rest, because I don't think it's true. I mean, you know, Anna Karenina by Tolstoy is about a woman's emotional life, and Madame Bovary, you know, there's... I think relationships are at the heart of novels, whether you have a backdrop of a war, whether you have a backdrop of political events or whatever. And I've written books which are set in the past. I've written, you know, 17th century Amsterdam. I've set contemporary novels. But basically, you know, I do deal with families, with relationships within families, because it is just a bottomless pit of fascination and evolvingness. And also, what the world is changing. I try and keep up with what's happening in the world, and it's changing so fast that if you write contemporary fiction, you have to really gallop to keep up with it. I mean, I've just finished a novel now, and, you know, this is 2017, and the world is, you know, an extraordinarily tumultuous, chaotic place. But, you know, by the time the novel comes out, you know, they will be a distant memory. The world comes in through sort of chinks in the doors and the windows. But basically, it's about human beings, about love, it's about pain, children, relationships, because that's really the core, I think, of novels. Read a non-fiction book if you want facts.
Well, it is, and even the way you describe chinks coming through the windows, it's just lovely to hear the way you even speak. So how did your writing career begin then, Deborah?
Well, I didn't want to do what my parents did, so I trained as a teacher. I worked in publishing. I was a waitress. I did lots of other jobs. And then in my mid-20s, I went to live in Pakistan with Mr. Mogar, my first husband, who's given me that name, but that nobody can pronounce, although you did very well. And when I was living in Pakistan for 2 years in the mid-70s, ages ago, I started writing because I felt very liberated from the past. I didn't want to do what my parents did, but I was living in a place where everything was different, and that made me feel very free. I didn't feel that anybody was over my shoulder saying, oh God, are you doing what your parents do? All that stuff. So I started writing for newspapers there and magazines, and they all got published because they were mostly Urdu magazines, and I wrote for English language ones, and the standard wasn't that high, so they published everything, which was great, because you saw your work in print, and that gives you confidence. And to write novels, you do need vast reservoirs of confidence. Even if you're a shy person and feel that you're inadequate in lots of ways, which a lot of novelists do, we all do, when you're sitting down and writing, you have to have confidence that the world wants to know about your characters that don't exist. So you need a huge amount of confidence. Gave me that because everything was published. And if you see it in print, you feel you're part of the professional world. And also being away from my background made me sort the past out. It gave it a shape, because when you're in the midst of life, your familiar life, it's sort of chaotic around you. But if you draw away from it and go and move somewhere else, it gives it a shape. You can start making shapes of the past and sorting order into it and all that. You know, your past and also the past of your character and things. So it was very great and liberating to go there. And also I sort of had time because I was, you know, I was a memsop. I was somebody who didn't have a job. So that helped. But that's not the most important thing, because I think that if you want to write, you will find the time. And when I came back, I had no time at all because I had tiny children and all sorts of other stuff going on. And I still worked every day and did the same amount.
Well, what a fascinating journey. So you're well known for the huge success of the Exotic Marigold Hotel film. Can you share more about it?
It came about because I was just thinking, how are we going to cope with all of us getting old? Because there's not the money or resources to look after us, because we're living too damn long, basically. We're also pale and hearty. And I thought that actually what we ought to do is to outsource the elderly. We outsource everything else, outsource the elderly to India, because it's cheap, it's warm, very good for arthritic joints. And there's a respect for the elderly on the subcontinent, which we don't have much in Britain anymore. And English is understood practically anywhere. There's a certain residual respect for the old Brits and the Raj. Children are incredibly well behaved and respect their elders. I mean, I thought, what's not to like, basically? So it did seem a mad idea, but not as mad as all that. And as it turned out, it was rather a clever idea, because it took off. So I wrote the novel, and it was optioned straight away. And this film was developed, and suddenly we had this stable full of absolutely fantastic, crackingly good actors. You know, lots of dames, Dame Judi Dench, Dame Maggie Smith, Penelope Wilton, Celia Imrie, who's far too young to be called old, Bill Nye, also far too young, who was Bliss, Tom Wilkinson, Ronald Pickup. I mean, we had a cast to die for. And they all went out to India. I mean, I think part of the reason they loved it was quite funny. It wasn't being defined by imminent death and disease and dementia when you talk about getting old. It was basically saying we're all the same people we've always been. We're just more wrinkly. And if we're up for it, retirement age needn't be retirement at all, because the world has changed so much and we can, you know, be kept alive longer or just live longer healthily. We've got another maybe 20 years to have another adventure if we feel like it. The thought of getting... It doesn't shy away from the difficulties of getting old. Old age is not for sissies. But it's really about something more positive. And I think that's partly why it was such a success.
I think it's a superb idea. And everyone should come to you about all of your ideas for social problems with your pragmatic social approach. And my goodness, you were nominated for a BAFTA for adapting Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice for the big screen with Keira Knightley. So how does that feel? I mean, A-listers Hollywood all round, including your family.
Yes, well, fun enough. I mean, Judi Dench starring in the film of Tulip Fever, which should be coming out as well. The Pride and Prejudice, that was quite a challenge because it's such a loved book. You feel a great sense of responsibility, and people who read it, like all of us, feel very protective of it and proprietorial about it, really. So that was a responsibility, but it hadn't been made as a movie. It had been done on television quite a lot, but it hadn't been made as a movie since Aldous Huxley did a screenplay back in the 50s. And I wanted this to be very realistic. I wanted it to be the Muddy Hem version. I wanted them to wear the same clothes, the same dresses every day, to show that the Bennets are on their uppers, you know, which is difficult to do when they're living in a nice house with a carriage. But actually, they were desperate for money. And I wanted it to feel truthful and no makeup on those young girls, and they should be the proper young age and all that. And Joe Wright, who directed it, came from realistic documentaries. So he was a very good choice because you did feel that this was a real place. It wasn't just a frothy costume drama in a gorgeous village with lovely, you know, dresses and things. It just felt truthful, and that it mattered, because it did matter. You know, it's not a joke that one of those girls has to be married off to Mr. Collins or somebody rich, because if they didn't, they would lose their inheritance, the entail of the estate, and they'd be cast out into the mud and darkness and poverty and dependence, as Jane Austen herself was a dependent. So I thought the humour, and of course it's wildly funny, but the humour stems from real desperation. And again, we had a really wonderful cast, and it was a pleasure.
So humour from desperation is obviously something that runs through. I mean, you mentioned Tulip Fever. That is a story about human greed and passion and big subjects. Tell us more about that.
Well, Tulip Fever, that was born from... I bought a painting, and if you go on my website, if you Google it goes on my website, and it's got a reproduction of the painting. I bought a painting at auction, 17th century painting, of a woman getting ready to go out, and it was painted at the same time as Vermeer was painting. So she's wearing a lovely little velvet jacket with a white ermine collar and cuffs, and a silky dress. And she's in one of those lovely Dutch Amsterdam interiors that we're so familiar with, which from paintings of checkerboard, black and white floor, you know, paintings on the walls, sunlight coming in through those heavily mullioned windows. And her maid is bringing her a necklace, and her manservant's bringing her a glass of wine. And she looks in the painting as if she's got a rather equivocal look on her face, and she looks as if really she's going somewhere she shouldn't be. And I hung her in my sitting room and gazed at this painting. And I wondered, where is she off? And I thought, she's up to no good. And I had to give a talk. And at the talk, it was about adapting books into films. And the final question at the talk from the questioner was, if you could write any film, what would you do? And I said, I would walk into a Dutch painting, because I'd been walking into it in my head, in my sitting room, for weeks. And there was somebody in the audience, a film producer, who said, how about make it into a movie? I actually then wrote it as a novel, but a very filmic novel. And when I was researching it, which was mostly looking at lovely Dutch paintings, I discovered about Tulip Mania, which was this extraordinary, mad period in 1636, when the whole of Holland went insane about gambling on tulip bulbs and what colour the blooms would be, and if they'd be what was called broken blooms, which was striped, and that those ones fetched a huge amount of money, hundreds of thousands of pounds in our money now. And I thought, what a wonderful symbol of greed, love of beauty, lust, you know, love, really, for these beautiful flowers. So I wove that into my plot, and it was such a filmic idea, beautiful tulips, Amsterdam in that period, all that, that Steven Spielberg bought it, and we developed it for several years, and our film collapsed. It was going to be the big British film of the year, and this is like 18 years ago, ages ago. It was going to be Keira Knightley, Jude Law, because it's a young painter who comes to paint a couple, a young woman and her older merchant husband, Jim Broadbent, Keira Knightley and Jude Law. And it was all about to be done. Tom Stoppard, in the end, did did the script, and it all collapsed. It was then built up again over the next many years, and Harvey Weinstein then took it over. And it has been made. It was made a couple of years ago with Alicia Vikander. Judi Dench is in it as an abbess who deals in tulip bulbs and grows them. Rather unreligious abbess, rather greedy, very money-minded. And it's got Jack O'Connell and Tom Hollander. It's got really great people in it. And it's made. I'm in it. I'm an extra. I'm always an extra in my own films.
What are you doing in it?
I'm a old crone sitting in a tavern drinking a pint of beer and smoking a clay pipe, my favourite role.
That's fabulous. I don't believe you'd pass for an old crone. She's completely timeless, this lady in front of me here. You had a pact with Tracy Chevalier because of The Girl with the Pearl Earring around the same time with your shared love of art history, romance and the secret stories the paintings tell. She obviously took you out for lunch, did she then?
She took me out to lunch at the Ivy because we had a bet that whoever's film was made first would take the other one out to lunch at the Ivy, because Girl with a Pearl Earring was also in difficulties at the time. That was being made and things had happened to that. But they did make it, obviously, with wonderful Scarlett Johansson. So she took me out to lunch. But also, there was another link in a way, because when the film collapsed, the next day, I mean, it made sort of headlines, this, because it was quite a big deal. The next day, a nursery phoned up from Thames Ditton who was holding 12,000 tulips for us in their pots. Each one was in a pot, and they were all sort of 6 inches tall in bud, because the tulips were going to bloom in about 2 or 3 weeks, which was the right point in the filming for them to be shot, like little actors. And so they said, what are you going to do with these 12,000 tulips now? You know, I haven't got a film. And I said, well, can you deliver 500 to my front garden in London, and the neighbours can take them? So the neighbours came round, they would live, the neighbours came round, and Tracy Chevalier, who lived nearby, she took some. And so every year, my film would come up in people's gardens in the form of tulips, which was the only sort of grace note in this sorry business, because when the film collapsed, many talented people lost their jobs because the film's just about to be shot and the sets were made and the costumes and everything.
My goodness, you've got so many fabulous stories within your stories. It's brilliant. And you support women, obviously, in this film business because you had a female director before and a talented female producer, Alison Owen, who produced Saving Mr. Banks in this one. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Alison Owen and I go back a long way, and she has been wonderfully steadfast in her enthusiasm and support for Tulip Fever, because she and I have been through very dark and rocky times with it because of it collapsing and because it was being very difficult to put it back together again. And we've worked on some other projects together, so I'm very, very fond of Alison. She's a very good producer, good taste, and also she's good fun.
That sounds a perfect mix for success. And an incredible director from the Mandela Walk to Freedom movie.
Justin Chadwick, who was completely brilliant. I was very keen on him, not because of that, because I hadn't seen the Mandela film, but because of Bleak House, which he did a groundbreaking Bleak House for the television over many episodes. And those of you who saw it, it was very dark and atmospheric and sort of dank. And you felt that other stuff was going on in other rooms. It was very Dickensian it was Bleak House, but it felt like a Dickens book in that it teemed with life. So you felt if you just, you know, looked in the corner of the screen, you'd see a whole lot of other stuff going on. And it was very atmospheric and wonderful. I thought it was completely brilliant. So we were lucky to have him because he did a very atmospheric job lighting and directing in these beautiful Dutch interiors which they built at Pinewood. So it was like walking to a Dutch painting. So my desire 20 years before to walk into a Dutch painting actually came true when I was shoved into this costume and could walk into this scene where I was this old crone. It was absolute heaven.
We're looking forward to seeing that. When's it coming out?
It's supposed to be the end of August in 2017, so let's hope it comes out.
And Norfolk Cloisters will be celebrating. They used some of it too, didn't they?
They did. Judi Dench is the abbess of Norwich Cathedral in the film, and they've transformed the cloisters into a great garden of tulips and also geese and pigs and God knows what. It's just a very wonderful scene. And, I mean, the amount of trouble they go for a very short scene, two short scenes, is just extraordinary. But we all know about filmmaking, what amazing efforts they make for things often hardly show up on the screen at all.
And Judy's obviously your favourite.
She's very salty in it. She's wonderful in it. She steals every scene. And it was very clever of them to cast her, because in the book and in the original film script, there is a small part for a very obsessive tulip grower. And they thought, it wasn't my idea, it was somebody else's idea, that let's turn this man into an abbess and let's get Judi Dench, because we need her in the film because she's so wonderful. And we'll build up the part and make her rather sort of salty and, as I was saying, rather interested in money. I mean, she's a dealer, and at one point she says abbess is just a cursory title. So it was great to have her. She's always wonderful. We all love her. Everyone loves her, and they love her as a person, they love her as an actress.
She's great, isn't she? We'd love to know more about your influences, and what do you do when you relax? What do you get up to when you're not writing?
Well, I swim in ponds. I love wild swimming, only in the summer, though. I'm too wussy for the winter. I like gardening. I like going for great long walks. I like walking or biking around London, looking in people's windows. I'm very nosy. I really do love bicycling around London. People say it's very dangerous and things, but I take back streets. I like that sort of thing. I like mucking about with my grandchildren, who, like all grandparents, have discovered it's the best fun in the world. And also you can give them back. I like singing. I like dancing. I've moved to Wales, where it's very sociable. I moved to a little border town where we do a lot of dancing at parties, which is kind of fun. I like singing and dancing. I like lots and lots of things, actually.
Gosh, you're one busy lady. Now, what are you truly happy doing? Do you read other people's books?
Of course. I mean, novelists should read all the time. I can't read when I'm writing a novel, though. So that means that, you know, large swathes of time, I'm not really reading. But there are certain novelists I read to sharpen up my prose style, like Beryl Bainbridge, I think, is a wonderful stylist. John Updike, I think, is a wonderful stylist. So I'll read a few pages of them just to get my senses sharp, my sort of literary senses sharp. My novelists I love reading nowadays, I love Tessa Hadley, who's a sort of new discovery. I read quite a lot of contemporary fiction, and American contemporary fiction as well. And sometimes it's so good that I can't see how they do it, and that's when they're really good, you know, because usually if you're another novelist, you sort of can get what they're at, but some people, they're beyond that. I read Middlemarch again and again, which is the greatest novel of all time, I think. So I read as much as I possibly can. I've always got two or three books on the go, unless I'm actually in the middle of writing one.
And do you have a mantra, how you live your life?
John Julius Norris quoted something once in the paper that his father told him, which I rather took to heart, which is that everything matters, but nothing matters that much, which I like very much. It's not nihilistic or depressing nor negative, but it has a sort of sense of proportion about it, but also a sense of enthusiasm and aliveness to life. But on my gravestone, I'd like to have the novelist epitaph, which is a plot at last.
You have got a fabulous sense of humour in the way you look at the world. But, and you've said another book's in progress. It's not actually world politics, though, is it?
It's not about politics. No. It's about a carer, actually. It's about a carer and an old man and middle-class guilt, because a lot of people foist their aged parents off onto other people, and then they often can be rather snotty about these carers who might take their old charges to, you know, Nando's or something. So it's about that, but it's got some big plot twists. I've had rather fun writing it, I must say.
We're looking forward to that. And lastly, what would you say to others wanting to change their life or career or follow their own dream?
Well, do exactly that. Follow your own dream. Life is extremely fleeting, even if you're getting old and hopefully have some more years ahead of you than people used to be able to look forward to. Don't be unhappy in your work, because people's work takes up, if they're lucky enough to be in work, takes up, you know, 8 hours a day. Find something that makes you happy. And there's very good books been written about people who've been computer programmers and feel they're, you know, going mad in cyberspace. And then they chuck it all in and, you know, repair motorbikes or something, and as happy as Larry. So, and be in charge of your own destiny. It's wonderful to be self-employed if one possibly can scrape a living doing that, and be beholden to nobody. When you write, nobody's looking at their watch when you sit down at your desk saying, you know, what time do you call this? And that's of great freedom, and we're very lucky to have that and to be able to make a living out of it.
So lastly, for budding writers like myself that want to write a book, has everyone got a book in them? Is it easy to adapt to a screenplay? I should think it's incredibly hard.
Well, adapting to screenplay is a whole big question, and it's a sort of knack. If you're a visual person and you've also got a good narrative muscle in your brain, it's not as difficult as all that. You have to have the temperament, if you're writing screenplays, you have to have the temperament to be able to be edited by other people. You know, at script meetings, they're going to say, this doesn't work at all, it's not funny, chuck it out. And you've got to be able to adapt to that. Novelists, you can be much more precious and protective of your work. So you have to be sort of open to criticism and communal writing if you're doing screenplays. But I think everyone's got millions of novels in them if they know how to access them and write them, because you don't have to have had a huge, rich, full life to write wonderful novels, as you know, we know from novelists who've been very shy and retiring, practically hermits, who don't seem to have, you know, gone out into the world. You don't have to go out in the world at all. It's all in your head.
Thank you so much, Deborah. We really appreciate your time. It's been an honour to meet you and hear your incredible talents and your poetic descriptions of life as an influential woman. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you to the lovely Jane. We'll give her a shout out for lending us her beautiful home here, surrounded by books in this wonderful country location. This Influential Women's podcast is produced by Nikki Bannerman and Juliet Nichols. Keep listening for more podcasts and subscribe for free downloads on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes Podcasts, on Stitcher and Audioboom.